Another Monday, another religious studies project. I'm David Robertson.
I'm Christopher Cotter.
And today we've got an interview with David Sloan Wilson on the subject of religion and evolution. And this is another Tommy Coleman interview. So take it away, Tommy.
This is Thomas Coleman for the Religious Studies Project, and today we are joined by a very special guest to discuss religion as an evolutionary organism. Our guest is Dr. David Sloan Wilson, who is an evolutionary biologist and professor at the Binghamton University in the Department of Biological Sciences. He has a new book out, Does Altruism Exist? Culture, Genes, and the Welfare of Others. It's just came out, I believe, this month. He has published very widely, researching many topics from an evolutionary perspective, and most importantly for today's topic, religion. Dr. Wilson, welcome to the Religious Studies Project.
Thank you very much.
I was hoping that you could give a brief overview and summary of some of your research interests, some of your past work, and some of the projects currently going on in your lab.
Well, sure. Well, I study lots of things. I'm trained as an evolutionary biologist, but cooperation and altruism, and in general, how groups function as adaptive units is a unifying thread of all of my research on humans and non-human species. And so that makes religion, of course, fit right into my wheelhouse, since religious groups tend to be very cooperative. Religious believers often refer to their groups as organisms. And so I take that metaphor very seriously, and I ask the question, of course, what is the nature of religion? To what extent are religious groups functionally organized? And is that what religion is all about? Is religion all about community? Is a familiar way to put the question, but I address that question scientifically from an evolutionary perspective.
Do you have any current projects ongoing right now? As I understand from the internet, and I've also heard at some conferences, that you have a large project going on that actually involves the city or town of Binghamton itself.
Right. So my formal interest in religion started about 17 years ago when I got a grant from the John Templeton Foundation to study forgiveness from an evolutionary perspective. And that led to my book, Darwin's Cathedral, which was published in 2002. And ever since, I've been working on religion. The current project, also funded by the John Templeton Foundation, is called the Binghamton Religion and Spirituality Project. And that studies religion and spirituality as practiced in the context of everyday life. Because on the one hand, religion and spirituality are these great traditions, they're millennia old, and we tend to think of them in those terms. But they wouldn't exist if they weren't also functioning for everyday people in the context of their everyday lives. And so we use the Binghamton area as a field site, as an evolutionist would understand the term. And all of the forms of religion and spirituality, both religious and secular, as a kind of a cultural ecosystem. So there's almost 200 congregations in our county, and then there's the many people that don't go to church, but they still have their beliefs, sometimes religion, sometimes not. And we use the conceptual tools, and in some cases the methodological tools, of evolutionary biology to study this kind of cultural diversity.
Speaking of cultural diversity and your work on religion, so I understand you're one of the leading proponents of the field of evolutionary religious studies. What is evolutionary religious studies, and how does it differ from, say, more traditional approaches to religious studies?
Right. Well, that's a great question. And if you go back to Darwin, he thought of all things human as a product of evolution in his own work. And but if you look at the history of evolutionary theory, what you find is that it became confined largely to biology during the 20th century. And the idea that evolution is a theory that can apply to all aspects of humanity in addition to the rest of life is something that began with Darwin but was then eclipsed for most of the 20th century. And so what that means is that a topic like religion has been developed in its own way. It has many branches, many different perspectives on our religion, most of them not from an evolutionary perspective. And so now, when we return to the idea that all aspects of humanity can be understood in some sense as a product of evolution, although that means cultural evolution in addition to genetic evolution, then this is very new, and there's a question as to what does it add? What's the added value when you approach a long-standing subject such as religion, which has received so much attention from other perspectives? What does it mean to study it from a modern evolutionary perspective? Would we just reinvent the wheel? Have smart people already discovered what there is to be learned about religion? Or is there some sense that a new perspective on this old subject can actually shed new light? And, of course, that's an empirical question. Mm-hmm. I think that evolutionary religious studies, in the formal sense of the word, began more or less at the turn of the century, the 21st century. And with books such as my own book, Scott Atran's In Gods We Trust, Pascal Boyer's Religion Explained, only at the turn of the 21st century did people with modern evolutionary training begin once again to turn their attention to this amazing phenomenon of our religion and spirituality.
Wanted to invite you to define some terms for our listeners that may come up in the podcast before we dive into the main topic. If you could briefly define inclusive fitness for us, what is it? What does it mean?
Let me introduce a collection of terms right off the bat, and then we can go through them one by one.
Great.
So we have inclusive fitness. We have kin selection. We have the selfish gene. We have reciprocal altruism. We have something called evolutionary game theory. We have group selection. We have multi-level selection. There's a whole constellation of terms which can be very confusing to the outsider, and frankly, they're very confusing to the insider as well. Now, all of these are theories of social evolution, and all of them really are directed towards answering one very important question, which is, how does altruism, cooperation, groups that work well, solid citizen behaviors, the puzzle is, the central problem is that for a group to function well, it requires members to perform services for each other, okay? Mm-hmm. And yet, those solid citizen behaviors tend to be vulnerable to exploitation by individuals who accept social benefits without providing them. These are problems of cheating and freeloading and exploitation in all of their forms. And so most of the traits that we associate with morality and with groups functioning well, because they're other-oriented or oriented towards the welfare of the group as a whole, then that makes them vulnerable to exploitation. And so it is a puzzle to explain how these solid citizen behaviors evolve as a product of natural selection. If evolution is about it favors individuals that survive and reproduce better than others, then how can we explain traits that cause others to survive and reproduce better than the focal individual? So that's the great puzzle of social life from an evolutionary perspective. And all of these theories are attempting to answer that question. Now, historically, these theories were developed as alternatives to each other. And so now I can begin to explain these terms one by one. Okay. So group selection theory is basically states that the way these altruistic solid citizen traits evolve is by a process of selection among groups. So even though selfishness beats altruism within groups, altruistic groups beat selfish groups. And so therefore, natural selection is pulling in different directions. At the most local scale, selfishness has an advantage. But if we increase the scale to competition among groups in a multi-group population, then a group of solid citizens has a robust advantage over a group that's crippled by selfish individuals. So this is a very straightforward explanation of how groups evolve to be adaptive units, but only when special conditions are met, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, Darwin had this idea, but in the 1960s, for a number of reasons, a consensus emerged among evolutionists that this idea didn't work. And so, therefore, altruism or apparent altruism needed to be explained in some other way. And one of the alternatives was called kin selection, and it was also called inclusive fitness theory. Those were two names for the same theory. And that more or less took note that altruism, if you think of it as a genetic trait, and if interactions take place among relatives, then there's a statistical probability that if I have an altruistic gene, that, and you are my relative, then you will also have that altruistic gene with a certain statistical probability. If you're my identical twin, then you're certain to have that gene. If you're my full sibling, then you have roughly a 50% probability, and so on and so forth. And so this became a way to explain how altruism can evolve, because by benefiting genetically similar individuals. And later that became generalized. So actually, you don't have to be my genealogical relative. There just has to be some clustering process where altruists preferentially interact with other altruists. You could be my friend, for example, and if I'm an altruist, I can choose altruists among my friends and things like that. And so this became a way to explain the evolution of altruism, which was thought to be an alternative to group selection. Now, so also for selfish gene theory and evolutionary game theory. I don't want to go into the details. The important thing is, and what has emerged and what your listeners need to know about, is that all of these theories have turned out to be equivalent. And what does that mean? It means that they all involve the same causal processes. They're like different perspectives, or a good way to think of them is like different languages. You might speak Russian, I might speak English. If we're not bilingual, then we cannot communicate with each other, but we're both explaining the same world. And so it turns out that the logic of multi-level selection, the idea that selfishness beats altruism within groups, in any group, including a religious group, the solid citizens are in danger of being exploited by selfish individuals. And nevertheless, a group of solid citizens does well compared to a group that's crippled by selfishness. That logic is actually included in all of the other frameworks. And so you can take your pick, whichever perspective you like, but you also need to be appropriately multilingual. And what you cannot do, or what is really no longer acceptable, is to argue these theories against each other, to say that kin selection is right, or inclusive fitness theory is right, multi-level selection theory is wrong. To a first approximation, that is like saying, like an Englishman saying, your language is confusing, you must speak English.
understand. Obviously, whether we're talking about inclusive fitness or multi-level group selection, natural selection is still, what is at work here? So I suppose the specific question would be, how do we understand or define a unit of selection? How do we know that religion is being selected for or of versus, I don't know, the local football team down the street, for example?
Right. Well, to get to that, first let me make another assertion, which is that there's more to evolution than genetic evolution. Once again, Darwin knew nothing about genes. He defined evolution in terms of variation, selection, and heredity. And heredity is any resemblance between parents and offspring. Nevertheless, as the science has developed and Mendel's peas were rediscovered, then evolution, the study of evolution, became highly gene-centric. So nowadays, when I say evolution, most everyone thinks genes. And that includes most of my professional colleagues. They define evolution in terms of a change in gene frequency. But if we go back and we define evolution in terms of heredity, not genes, then we can see that there are other mechanisms of heredity. In other words, other ways that parent offspring resemble parents, and that these count as evolutionary processes just as much as genetic evolution. And so that enables us to study, for example, cultural change as an evolutionary process. And religions are coming and going and mutating all the time. And Christianity and every other major religious tradition is a great bushy tree of religious beliefs and practices. These are, for the most part, cultural traits. They're not directly emanate from our genes. Our genes create our whole minds, and, you know, our genes are involved in giving us a capacity for cultural change, but the actual cultural change is its own evolutionary process. Now, against that background, we can take a belief, and let me pick one because we don't need to be abstract. Mm-hmm. One belief is the belief in the afterlife associated with early Christianity. An end of days followed by a resurrection. And so this is, when you study this from a naturalistic perspective, in other words, we're functioning here as scholars, methodological naturalism means that you don't invoke supernatural explanations. You explain things in terms of the known causal forces of the world. So therefore, a belief in the afterlife and a resurrection is a belief. It arose at a certain time in history, and it spread compared to other beliefs. Now, what do we know about the origin of this belief? It turns out we know a lot, because religious scholars have been very busy. They haven't been using the E word, but we know a lot about the history of religions during biblical and pre-biblical times. And so we know that the concept of the resurrection associated with early Christianity did not exist in Judaic thought until relatively late. The first full-throated expression is the Book of Daniel. And scholarship has determined, I mean, beyond anyone's doubt, there's no disagreement about this, that this is one of the last books to be added to the Hebrew Bible, and it can be dated to about 300 before the Common Era. So this was an idea that arose and didn't, for the most part, exist. Before that, the concept of the afterlife was Sheol, that gloomy place where we all go, whether we're good or bad. And that was similar to Hades in pagan thought. We know that even Sheol was invoked rarely, that the Bible mentions a death over 1,000 times, but Sheol over only 70 times, the Hebrew Bible. And so even the concept of Sheol, that concept of the afterlife, is invoked rarely and only in a certain context. And so how did the concept of the resurrection arise? Do we know enough about the social context to know why it arose, what it did, if anything? Because part of being an evolutionist is not everything has a function. There's many products of evolution which are not adaptive. They might be byproducts. They might be, and there's a whole list of non-adaptive explanations for products of evolution. So we need to ask the question in the same way that we'd ask for a genetic trait, this cultural trait, do we know enough about the context to know why it existed and why it spread? And the answer is we do. There's not much controversy about it. It arose in the context of between-group conflict within Judaism. And the Maccabean Revolt was not the first time it was used, but it was a similar context of a fundamentalist sect within Judaism in conflict with the larger body of Jews, who in this case were assimilating to Hellenistic culture. And so this was a solidarity mechanism. And it was very much a group-level adaptation, basically. Groups that believed this would have more solidarity in their conflict with other groups than if they didn't. Now, it doesn't mean that they'd win.
So sort of like a social cohesion, like a Durkheimian functional perspective.
Very much so. And so modern evolutionary religious studies is actually validating a lot of what Durkheim thought. I often call it neo-Durkheimianism. But that's not to say that Durkheim was right in every respect. And the tradition of functionalism, which Durkheim pioneered, one problem with it was that it became axiomatic, that cultures were always interpreted in functional terms, and there wasn't much attention to how cultures became functional. And so these were problems with functionalism. But now what we can say is that most enduring religions are functional at the group level. They work well as groups. And so the idea that a enduring religion is an organism of sorts actually can be validated by evolutionary theory.
It brings me to the next question. Is religion, with some scare quotation marks around the word religion, really what's being selected for? Or is it simply groups and communities that cooperate and have a shared worldview, of which some of these may be things or groups we call religion?
I would think I would edge more towards the latter. And I think that what's more general than religions are meaning systems. And a meaning system is a set of symbolic relations that receive information as input and result in action as output. And so and now everyone has a meaning system. As humans, without exception, every normal functioning human has a meaning system. Every human is not religious. And so a religion is one kind of meaning system. So I think it's very important to understand what we mean by meaning systems. And then to ask the question, what is this subcategory that we're impelled to call religion? And what distinguishes it from other kinds of meaning systems? And there you can pick out many things. I think one of the points that some of my colleagues make, and I actually forgot to mention that our project, the Binghamton Religion and Spirituality Project, is a collaboration with colleagues in England, Harvey Whitehouse and John Landman and others, we're studying religion from an evolutionary perspective more broadly. And one of the themes of our project is that religion is a very, very fuzzy set. And so you have to pick out many religious traits. Is it belief in supernatural agents? Is it ritual? What is it? And so we have to recognize that just almost everything central to religion also exists in a non-religious formulation.
Could a science of religion progress if we didn't posit functional groups? Well, would it be possible?
Let me make sure I understand your question.
Could a science of religion make progress? Could we have a science of religion if we didn't posit or say that there were functional groups?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I'm going to say no, but I'm going to take a little while to get to no. Okay? Because I think from the very beginning, when scholars began to be interested in religion, and I guess we could roughly date that to the 19th century, when people like Durkheim and William James and in the early 20th century really began to, Tyler, Fraser, all these people began to just, well, what is this thing religion? And I think that everyone that's interested in religion is puzzled by its irrational aspect. Why is it that we believe in these things for which there's no factual evidence? And why is it that based on this belief, we engage in acts that seem so costly and which don't seem to bring benefits? And often we kill ourselves, it seems, for these beliefs. What could be less beneficial than that? And so religion appears to be both irrational and dysfunctional. And that sets it apart from more utilitarian things. So if I make an igloo, then that's easy to understand. An igloo is useful. Mm-hmm. If I sacrifice blankets to a god, that seems that's hard to understand, right?
I would agree.
And so back to the old pioneers, there's explanations, there's theories of religion as something that's non-functional. And there's theories of religion that are functional despite appearances, okay? And Durkheim was the champion of religion as something that has great secular utility despite appearances, right? So what we should think of is we should think of functional explanations of religion and non-functional explanations of religion as alternative theories, basically, as alternative hypotheses that can be true or false, or maybe they're both true. You know, I mean, it doesn't have to be categorical. Okay, now, and this has been debated from the very beginning. Now, what I claim is that evolutionary religious studies, people who are studying religion from an evolutionary perspective, have settled this issue more than it was settled before. That when we started out at the turn of the 21st century, this was being debated in the same way that it was debated a century before. But now, because the evolutionary approach is actually really good at determining, at evaluating functional explanations. That's what we do as evolutionists. And so we basically use the tools of evolutionary biologists, the tools of evolutionary theory, and we started to really test the hypothesis. Is this aspect of religion a byproduct? Is it mismatched? Was it adaptive in the past, not the present? Was it a product of drift? Did it evolve as a selfish parasite, cultural parasite? Did it evolve on the strength of selfish individual benefits? Did it evolve by benefiting whole groups, not other groups? And the progress that's resulted from that is that we can say with a good deal of scientific confidence at this point is that most enduring religions are good for the group. They're functional at the group level. And so now, if we return to your question, you say, can there be a study of religion that doesn't take group level functional organization into account? I would say no, because that would ignore the progress that has been made. Science says that religions, enduring religions, are very much about creating strong groups. And if you were to ignore that, basically, you'd be ignoring the empirical truth about religions.
You were mentioning testing evolutionary hypotheses, and as I understand, when we're doing this, we're not actually testing the theory of evolution itself, but we are testing specific hypotheses about religion. I was hoping you could give the listeners an example of a specific hypothesis relating to religion that you're working on testing currently.
Right, and so let me go back to the example of the resurrection, the concept of the afterlife. Even though that's historical research, we are testing hypotheses. Now, one very common hypothesis of religion is that it exists to allay our anxiety about death. And so this hypothesis goes, there's informal versions and there's formal versions, but basically it goes, first we evolved to be self-aware. That's adaptive. But then we became aware of our death. That was anxiety provoking. And so therefore we invented a belief in a glorious afterlife as a way to allay our fear of death. There's a whole branch of scholarship called terror management theory, which is based on this. Now, we could go back to the historical record and we can look to see when this concept emerge, and it could have emerged for that reason. Or another thing we would predict is that belief in a comforting afterlife would be some kind of religious universal, right? Mm-hmm. Well, it's not. So that's hypothesis testing. That's what you do that's what the historical sciences are all about. Now, you could also, in a more laboratory situation. And this is work by people such as Aaron Orenzayan, who you've interviewed. You could basically experiment by priming people with religious primes, and you can show that they become more cooperative. You can put those eyeballs on the coffee can, and you can show that people contribute more. And so, I mean, his thesis is that particular conceptions of God emerge to help foster cooperation in large scale society. So hypothesis testing can take place at many levels. One thing I did shortly after writing Darwin's Cathedral was I studied a random sample of religions. There's a lot of cherry picking that goes on, where you have a theory, and then you choose a religion that supports your theory. But what you should really do is you should pick a random sample of religions, and then you should evaluate all the theories using a random sample. That's just basic scientific methodology. Mm-hmm. So what I did was I took Eliade's 16-volume Encyclopedia of Religion, and I wrote a little computer program that shows volumes are random and pages within volumes are random. So basically, I parachuted into the encyclopedia at a random spot. And at that entry, I said, is this entry about a religion? And if it wasn't, I just paged forward until I got my first entry about a religion. I picked 36 religions chosen without respect to any hypothesis. And then I studied those religions, not just from the encyclopedia, but the whole literature. And there, again and again and again, you would discover that these religions are just straightforwardly about community. Even the Eastern religions, which on first blush don't seem very communitarian, end up being very communitarian. Jainism was a good example. Jainism, ascetic Jains often go naked. They have to beg for food. They give away all their belongings. They don't kill any little creature. It just seems like they've been, if ever there was a cultural parasite, it would seem to be this. And I had to study Jainism because it ended up in my sample. And at first it said, okay, this is going to be, this is something that's going to go into the cultural parasite bin. Quite the contrary, Jainism is an amazing religion. And the ascetic Jains are a tiny fraction of the religion. The lay Jains are among the wealthiest merchants in India. And the religion is very much, it's culturally convergent with Judaism. It's a merchant religion. And it very much helps the groups cooperate in a middleman merchant economic a niche. And it is convergent with other middleman cultures, including Judaism in Western Europe, Chinese in Asia, Indians in Africa. It's an example of convergent cultural evolution. And an economist named Janet Landa has developed that thesis. Really interesting.
And bringing the interview towards a close here, I was hoping you could provide a take-home, takeaway point for our listeners in understanding religion as an evolutionary organism. What would you like them to know most of all?
Well, we've been stressing a lot of the academic end of things, but the religion and Binghamton Religion and Spirituality Project, because it does study these things in the context of everyday life, that means that we work with the faith community. And that includes both the leaders, the pastors, and the congregations, and that turns out to be equally fulfilling. And that's really a game changer, because the new atheists and all the conflict between science and religion, evolution and religion, as if they'll never be compatible. But we make them very compatible, including with the fundamentalist wing. And why is that? It's in the first place, we're very respectful of religions, because I'm respectful of a religion in the same way that I'm respectful when I study a beehive or a multicellular organism. I admire all three. And also, I very much want communities to work well. And if religious communities work well and they don't do harm, then what would I do then to actually help them to thrive? And so there's actually some common ground that enables us to work with our non-academic partners in a way that is really a two-way street. And some of the best conversations I've had are with the pastors who know much more than I ever will, because it's their job, it's their calling to actually create these communities and make them strong. And if they don't know that religion is all about community, nobody could, because their communities depend on it. So that gives a whole new dimension to the study of religion and spirituality that takes it out of the ivory tower.
Very interesting. And if any of our listeners would like to find out more about your work and research, is there a website or a blog that they could go to?
We do, and you can list them along with this podcast, but let me briefly list them. First, my new book, Does Altruism Exist?, covers a lot of this. Let me, as a teaser, if I have just an extra minute, if you look at altruism is defined in two ways, in terms of action, what you do, and thoughts and feelings, how you think. And what my book shows, based on quite extensive scholarship, is that religions actually do not appeal to altruism. Altruism, defined as something which benefits you at my expense, is foreign to the imagination of almost all religions. Almost all religions are framed that if you do the right thing, you plus everyone else will benefit. And so that's a very interesting aspect which we have not covered in this interview. But quickly, my book, Does Altruism Exist?, the online magazine, This View of Life, which has a religion section. And This View of Life covers all topics from an evolutionary perspective. And then the Binghamton Religion and Spirituality Project has a website so that you can see what's going on in Binghamton.
Dr. David Sloan Wilson, we thank you very much for being on the program today.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much for another excellent interview there, Tommy. Should say, we are presented in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions. And it was great hearing that interview there. It was reminding me of another one of the first interviews that we did, one of the first ones that we did together with Bron Taylor on Religion After Darwin. So there's clear tie-ins there. So if you want to dive into the archive.
And Bron turned 60 this week. So happy birthday, Bron.
Happy birthday to you. I can't keep singing that because that's copyright.
Indeed, yeah. That was fair usage, but if you'd have gone on.
Yeah. One thing that's not really copyright is the RSP. We've got a Creative Commons license.
Right.
So you can use us and incorporate us into whatever teaching or whatever resources you want, as long as you attribute it, point everyone to the original source and tell them that was from the Religious Studies Project.
Indeed, and we are very keen for you to do so. In fact, if you are doing so, or if you intend to do so, we'd be keen to hear from you, because we're thinking of running a little series about how the Religious Studies Project material has been used in various teaching contexts, and how different groups, undergraduates, postgraduates, and teaching staff have found it to be. So do get in touch, editors@religiousstudiesproject.com.
Next week, we've got an interview from Jack Sonis with Milad Milani on Sufism. So it's, potentially quite a broad interview there, but on a topic that's quite a narrow topic, even within the study of Islam. And Islam, much like Christianity, is something that we really haven't touched on in this.
Yeah, we haven't been able to do much on that. We've done a little bit of Christianity, but Islam not so much.
And this has been kind of intentional on our part, because a lot of the stereotype of religious studies is that it's just about studying world religions. And also, we're well aware, particularly in the UK, that all the jobs at the moment are Islam, 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 Islam. So we're trying to not bow to that. But this will be pretty much our first sort of holy Islam podcast. And it'll be great.
Pun intended.
That's fantastic.
Okay, that's a good note to end on, I think. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, on Google+, kind of, on iTunes. Thanks again to the BASR. Don't forget to use our Amazon links if you want to support the project at no extra cost. And also don't forget that we want to say...
thanks for listening.